done on this legislation and the wording of the section, because the wording as it is does not take into account the Action 3 final report. Secondly, we also want to sketch a story to show how a very significant unintended consequence of the current wording of the inclusion to trust will pan out. You will have foreign foundations and foreign trusts, and these could be family trusts, or these could be charitable trusts such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Harvard Foundation, Warren Buffett Foundation, amongst many others. South Africa is the recipient of many of these philanthropic contributions from overseas. Now, if these overseas foundations, and they could also be family foundations, and if these foundations owned more than 50% in foreign companies, as these foundations and family trusts could and possibly very likely do, then any beneficiary of these foundations, foreign foundations of trust, when they receive distributions from these trusts, these beneficiaries in South Africa would be taxed in South Africa as income. There is no recognition at all on the type of income which is being distributed by the foreign foundation or trust. It could be rental income, it could be interest income, it could be the capital which is contributed by the philanthropy person, but none of this is taken into account. Section 25BC is very wide, and it simply means that your impoverished person, the significantly disadvantaged individual in South Africa who probably isn't even registered to pay tax, will now be subject to tax in terms of Section 25BC. That surely is not the intention. You've got foreign family trusts, and it just so happens that there is one family member who is a South African resident. Now that South African resident as well will be subject to tax on income. You have heard before
you have
that...
We have 10 minutes already, but it's fine. We'll give some latitude because we've got enough time.
Thank you. You have heard before as well that the income which is being distributed, there is no recognition at all on the nature and quality, and that is precisely the case. It could be rental income, it could be interest, and there's no recognition of that. The CFC legislation itself does provide for exemptions and recognition that there shouldn't be further tax, further South African tax on the CFC if, for example, that CFC is already paying a high foreign tax, or if the CFC is legitimately carrying out business in the foreign country. 25BC unfortunately does not give any recognition to that. We have in our Income Tax Act a provision which provides for exemption to dividend income from being included in income tax, subject to income tax, if you hold more than 10% in the foreign company. The wording of 25BC does not give any recognition to that at all. It surely cannot be the intention that an individual who holds shares directly is going to be in a better position than a resident beneficiary of a foreign trust that holds shares in foreign companies. And so with that note, we strongly request, please do consider and please conduct more extensive research on other countries that do include trusts, and also the recognition that there are many significant unintended negative consequences to South Africa.
Questions, members.
Alf. Floyd. We've covered a huge amount of ground, and some of it I must say I'm just a bookkeeper and not the expert you sometimes profess me to be.
We'll get to me anyway.
So I was a little lost, and so there's going to be some time. But fascinated, and it's not just because it came at the end. The question of philanthropy or goodwill from abroad suddenly being taxed in the recipient's hands and South Africa. I'm sure that's not the intention, and I hope Younger and Chris and co. will be re-looking at the words on that one. But just as an aside, Mr. Chairman, I'm quite proud at this moment to have as a lifetime friend a certain Mark Webber, whose great uncle was the founder of the firm that's just been addressing us. Mark is an attorney, but practices in Lesotho, for what it's worth, Mr. Chairman. So it's worth nothing. So there you go. I really have no more comments, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to hearing the response from National Treasury.
What's the EFF's position on this? What's your mandate? You think about it, right? Masani, Gloria, Sakele, Antonia.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Just want to comment on the last presentation. There's two issues. I think there's the issue of the Action 3 point where, you know, legislation need to sort of refer to it when you look at the implications of the trusts and the CFC definitions and try to look at it. I think just a comment which I think our treasury colleagues will also comment there, you know, how far about it is the trying to, firstly, what is the obligation to try to include all these provisions within our legislation, and how far about, you know, do you include and which one do you include? As far as we're concerned, there isn't an obligation to outrightly take everything into account, but I think there's an interesting point to raise, say, how do we refine the definitions to try and include which section of it. I think there's just a point there. But I think, Chair, the issue of trust is a very topical issue every year. I think what we said some time back was to say there's a objective to try to use trust as a vehicle to avoid taxes as much as possible. But equally, there's a flip side to it to say it's used as what's the purpose of it. And I think it would be interesting to get the response from Tajari in that aspect to say, I understand the concerns that are raised by including trust, you know, into CFC, the provision that we discussed last. But it would be interesting, the big issue which I was saying to Gloria that, you know, we sit here and get different sides of the story. But I think we need to get the details. What are the real specific concerns versus the benefits that we expected the provision to bring for the legislation? Thanks.
Gloria? You're passing. Anybody else to say anything? No. Just one quick thing, one notice. Tandi Tobias, who mainly focuses on tax from side of the ANC, she's sick, she sent us a notice. She's not here. Firstly, I want to say Capitec, you know, we're working at the moment, the chairperson of Trade and Industry and myself, to finalize a report on the transformation of the financial sector. Can I alert members that you'll get it by tomorrow? It's a humongously long report. I've never had to manage a more difficult report because you have to find all the balances. Zakele and his team have done a superb job of an overview, but the recommendations are political, and it's the chairs that have to do it. So Joan was held up because she was on special leave last week. She's going through it, so hopefully by Thursday morning you'll get it. Just to alert you that the idea is next week it will be an interim report that we hopefully will adopt. It will go to the stakeholders for 2 or 3 weeks. They will respond, and we'll do a final report early in October. So I'm urging members to be here on the 6th. The second thing that strikes me, by the way, you might be interested. I know you're going to shudder and so on. But you know what? We're going to manage this thing temperately, sensibly, respecting people's individual rights to privacy and the tax dispensations the world over. But we've mandated, for your interest, can you come tomorrow with your initial input, if you're ready, our advocate there, Jenkins, with the parliamentary unit, on the issue of illicit financial flows. We feel very strongly that, you know, every time we ask South African Revenue Service, you know, there's all these claims of millions and millions and billions of rands disappearing. Obviously not doing our job. When we ask them about cases, and they will say, we can't tell you anything. Fine, you can't tell it in the public domain. But we're reaching a stage where we think that we should explore the possibilities, like the Intelligence Committee has, to have closed meetings, where if I am accused of stealing billions of rands, and, you know, I must be called there to give my side of the story, and SARS and FIC must be called there and say, hey, what are you guys doing about this? Maybe the person's innocent. So let's sort this matter out. They won't even tell you whether they're investigating. So we've asked Advocate Jenkins, if any of you would like to send to Thabo and Alan a one-page or two-page on that matter, are there experiences elsewhere in the world where a closed parliamentary committee can look at issues like this? I hear what you say, Keith. I know tomorrow I'm worried about a certain person here. You know, there's a piece in the City Press this week. I've heard that. The mining, by the way, the mining people want to see us. Can you remind me, Thabo, I'll ring them after 2 o'clock, about a report. Look, the position of the majority in this committee on illicit financial flows, which we obsessed about, let me tell you, rightly so, Parliament has been too soft for too long. You see, it doesn't matter whether it's one rand or 100,000 billion rands, it's still wrong. So people can come here, Keith, into, you know, there's different realities, we focus too much on what maybe global financial integrity says. You can, you know, you must engage in all of that. That's your area, about the methodology and the scientific value. We don't care. We don't care. We don't care whether it's one rand or 100 million rands or 100 billion rands. We want people to pay their taxes, and if they don't pay, they must go to jail. It's a crime. That's all. We're not interested in it. So if global financial integrity's got the figure wrong, or Mbeki got it wrong, so what? If it's not 50 billion, what is it? Maybe 49 billion and a half. So what? Still wrong. So if you've got any, if you can help us, you're not likely to want to help us because your clients won't be impressed. But if you want to write to us confidentially, or you want to slip something under my door, P73, do so. Yeah, I see. That stunned me, by the way. Never happened in this parliament before. And really, that was stunning. Okay. Now, on Capitec, I must say, you know, at the moment, Joan and I are very warm towards you, right? We read a lot about you and how you enter this market and you're doing well. So I'm very interested in his case, unapologetically, right, for the unsecured loans. This committee feels bank charges in general are too high, and you've come into the market and you reach the lower income and you're doing extremely well. So we must congratulate you, really. So at the moment, you know, we are very sympathetic to you. Obviously, we won't be emotional and over politically driven and say you can get what you want because you cater for constituents. No, we have to be rational, right? Otherwise, these people take us to court. So, and we can't behave like that, right? I mean, really, we're not that sort of extreme populistically oriented. On the sledgehammer approach, we hear this all the time, right? Again, this is like, you know, there are terms people use that we get, with due respect, we get very suspicious about. Haven't been consulted. Yeah, I think on both sides of the case, sledgehammer. Actually, sometimes we discover you do use a sledgehammer more than most other, let's say, departments or entities. Actually, it's true, right? At least it's my personal subjective experience. When they use it here, it's worth more. I don't know at the moment that I want to raise. I may make some inane points. It's not of any value to anybody. I would like to read more and get a better, firmer grip of things. Yanga, over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. There are three issues that I'd like to raise. BASA and the sledgehammer approach and the issue of foreign trust. With regard to the BASA and Capitec submission, what is happening is that the current system SARS gave a ruling regarding banks because banks are highly regulated for provisioning of bad debt. So it's like you claim now, but as soon as the bad debt becomes bad, they can still claim that debt in full. But now this is a provisioning for claiming the bad debt. So it's a timing issue. So they were given this ruling. So when we're moving to IFRS 9, because this ruling was based on IAS 39, so we wanted to review this. So, and then We had a meeting with them to say, must it apply to all financial institutions or must it apply only to banks? I want to say, why is there a reference to the Banks Act? And then during the meetings, they told us that they are highly regulated by the Reserve Bank of capital adequacy requirements. Hence now, our proposal refers to Regulation 67 of the Banks Act because we wanted to tie in with the higher regulation with the Banks Act and the Reserve Bank. So that is the issue. And with regard to Capitec, we have their view, and I think we're still going to meet on the 4th and 5th of September to iron out the issue. But when we had meetings with the banks, the 85% that we are proposing here, it seems to be fair, because when we had meetings with them, it was like 75%, 80%, and then it come up to 85%. And we want to emphasize, Chair, that when the debt really becomes bad, they're still going to claim in full. But it's the timing issue. That is the main issue. That is the first thing. On second thing, on the share buybacks and dividend stripping, the fact that we are using a sledgehammer approach, yes, we've looked at all the comments and the fact that they should apply to extraordinary dividends. So when we respond in the response document, we're going to take into account those comments. And then the third one on the debt relief. As Ben said, that you create an incentive and the incentive creates a loophole. So here we're trying to assist companies in distress, but at the same time you have to have carve outs for anti-avoidance. So this is what we have done. So if the carve outs are found to be too restrictive, we are going to look at them, and then when we come on the 12th of September for the response statement, we're going to say which cover-outs we're going to take out from the bill, which cover-outs are restricted, and all that we're going to do, because there are some certain areas whereby we agree, but there are areas whereby we can see that it's prone to anti-avoidance. And then the fourth one, on the foreign trust and the CFC and the OEC, we want to say that South Africa had CFC legislation long before 2001. It was called Controlled Foreign Entity in 1997, long before the BEPS. Even on the BEPS report, they commended our controlled foreign company rules in the BEPS report that they are too good. So what we are saying is that now we are trying to bring back the foreign trust whereby they circumvent CFC by putting a foreign trust. But we take into account the issues whereby it's a philanthropic trust, it cannot be caught by these rules. But we're going to make these rules clear that Section 25BC is subject to Section 90, and the issue of foreign tax credits we're going to clear it out on the response document. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Then can we have responses from the participants from outside Parliament? In the order that you spoke, if you like. Basa first.
I think the only comment that we want to make on the hook that the allowance should actually be hangs on, that's on stage three. The definition of credit impaired, as I stated in IFRS 9, we believe is a better hook due to the fact that all the models that the banks are actually implementing will be accounting models, credit impairment models. And we believe that the level of credit impairments between, if you compare the definition of in Regulation 67 of into default and credit impaired is in any event going to be on the same kind of level. So we just think it's going to be simpler and easier to actually link to the definition of credit impaired in any first line. Then I think another point is once an impairment has been raised from an accounting point of view. If it's in stage three, the next thing that happens is the actual write-off point. So in other words, the hit to the income statement already incurred, the only further thing that happens is the actual write-off of that bad debt against the provision. If that is aggressive, that point is aggressively brought forward, then that means that the allowance that would be granted is effectively 100%, because on an actual bad debt write-off, you get 100% allowance. So all that we are pleading for is that there should be fairness, and that we are happy as BALSA for stage 1 and 2 to actually be allowed 25%, but we reiterate the point that we feel that the playing field will be more level if 100% is allowed on stage 3 and they be linked straightforward to IFRS 9. Thank you very much.
Capitec? Just in addition to that, I want to raise the point around the timing difference of the deferred tax asset. The only way that you'll be able to utilize the benefit of that deferred tax asset in the future would be when you actually decrease your loan book over time, or you raise no more provision and you write off completely in the following year. So the impact of a change of this allowance and provision and raising a big deferred tax, that timing difference, will actually stay on the balance sheet as long as you stay in business or as long as you actually decrease your loan book. Other than that, the deferred tax asset remains and impacts your capital adequacy ratio.
Okay, who's next? It was Law Society. Where are you? Ah, then. We might finish before 2.
Weber Wenzel, I'd like to respond to Younger's comments on the foreign trust. I think it is an excellent idea to exclude the application of 25 BC for philanthropic contributions by the trust. I also do want to urge that more extensive research be done to fine-tune how that will be defined, because you may have foreign trusts, foreign family trusts, that also make philanthropic contributions to named organizations or to specific individuals like scholarships or bursaries, or even family members who need the funding. So please, could the scope of the contributions be explored in further detail? Thank you.
Okay, Keith, you can take another half an hour now, because nobody wants to speak.
I always want to speak, but I'm not sure if you want to listen.
Sorry, yeah. Do you want to say something else? Yes, please.
Treasury, is it possible at all that the 25 BC amendment be postponed for a year to allow more research into this? Is this a consideration?
Yaga, you want to think about it?
We'll think about it. It's part of the package of the amendment in Section 90, because 90 amendments go together with Section 25 BC. But what we can do is to fine-tune 25 BC to even clarify that they'll get foreign tax credit, double taxation, and all that. And then after we fine-tune, then we can talk.
Okay, because it can stand alone, the I or the Roman I, B Roman 2, because you could conceivably just pass through B Roman 2, which talks about IFRS 10, and then only pass BI and 25 BC in another year. So that is also a possibility. Thank you.
Fred from Law Society.
Sorry, thank you. I'm not sure that it's a consensus view that just applying the IFRS 10 test is necessarily the right one, because under IFRS 10, as I understand it, not an accountant, you can control a company for accounting purposes where you don't hold 50% of the shares. So you can end up with quite a weird situation where if you go through a trust or if you have accounting control, you're in a worse position than if you have normal legal control. So I'm not sure that there's consensus on that. Sorry, I just wanted to respond. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Indeed, it is a consensus, and we have raised that comment, thank you, in our submission document. But it is a written comment, and for the purposes of today, we just narrowed it on foreign trust. Yes, there are a lot of issues. Firstly, referring to an accounting standard in a legislative instrument which is passed by Parliament, number one. Number two, the way the IFRS 10 works is that you consolidate the accounts and then you take out the minority interest at the bottom of it. So how are you going to attribute a provision or an attribution percentage to the parent company at the top? That's another concern. IFRS 10, the actual standard itself is about 120 pages long. And so, I know we've talked a lot about complexity. So The third point I want to raise is that Action 3 of the final report does talk about a lot of different ways of measuring control. And as Robert has pointed out, it is, you know, how can you make accounting control more important than legal control? And IFRI 10 is actually just one example of the accounting standard referred to on page 25. So I am, as urged before again, please can we consider this, both aspects actually now, B Roman I and B Roman 2 of the new definition of CFC, both need to be relooked more closely, and perhaps both need to be postponed to another year. And I think Robert is in agreement. Thank you.
We are not proposing that you do postpone it. We ask that you respond to her proposal. The other thing to alert you to, if it's necessary at all, when we ask the Treasury to engage with you, it's not to give in to you. It's actually to have a give and take approach, right? And ultimately, you can agree. But if we as Parliament don't agree, based on the inputs and advice we get from our research staff here and the MPs, those of us who are more technically knowledgeable are better able to shape the outcomes. But ultimately, these are political decisions. So we hear everybody. And you might strike a deal with Treasury, but we might say no, as long as that's the understanding. Right? Although as far as possible, the other thing that strikes me, listening to people and getting a better understanding now of the issues, is, you know, you're having these workshops, younger, first week of September. Then you're going to when will you have finished that process?
We'll have workshops on the 4th and the 5th of September. And then during workshops, we tell them that this is a provisional response because the response should be formal on the response document that we submit to in Parliament on the 12th, whereby we say accepted, not accepted, we're going to change it.
Yes. Do you want more time? Because the gap seems to be quite big, even by the standards of the usual. I mean, invariably, nobody wants to pay taxes. They're not naive. But we think, given the parlous situation of the economy, and given the prospects that, you know, in the next cycle of 3 years, the projections are pretty low, we need to, like, carry people with us, but at the same time not forego revenue simply for that reason. So we need to find all these balances, which obviously you as Treasury and us as parliamentarians need to secure. The question I'm simply asking you is, we would like you to come to Parliament on the 12th or whenever, having taken these workshops and negotiations as far as you possibly can in the time span and circumstances. So we can put the meeting back by a week or so, if that's what you want. So you will let us know. So you let us know in the next 48 hours so that we can plan. But there's nothing stopping you after you have these workshops on the 5th or 6th coming to us and saying, hey, Eunice, you know what? We need more time. Because we'd rather you came here on the 12th or the 19th or whatever with, let's say, having exhausted and saying, no, we're not going to give in. Even if we sit for another 2,000 days, we're not going to give in. That's fine. Then the exchange that we have on the 12th or whenever thereafter between yourselves and the stakeholders here and the committee is, let's say, easier to manage. I'm pleading because we've got so much of legislation. We've finished the insurance bill, we've got the transmission of the financial sector report, we've got the audit rotation report, we've got a whole lot of things, SAA, National Treasury. I'm trying to find time for the insurance bill, Yanga, and I just can't find the time. So what I'm saying in short is, will you come back to us? So the date is tentative, right? Okay. Yeah, and so that's done. Okay, Yanga, what did you say?
Thank you, Chair. I will come back to you, but as you have read all the comments, but there are six big issues here, of which you already know. It's the share buybacks, Section 10(1)(o) exemption, bargaining council, BASA impairment, CFC, and debt relief. So these are all the six. And based on the comments we have they've said, and on the comments we have received, we've already read them, and we sort of know that what their comments are and what you're going to agree on and what you're not going to agree on. But we think that the time frames are still okay, but we're going to come back to you.
Thank you very much. Then let's move on to Groot Point. We're a bit ahead of time, a good deal ahead of time. Okay, Groot Point, very. Just say finally, you know what, I really think it's discourteous, and you know, you're going to be taken seriously by Parliament, to watch a chairperson use the SMS that I do. Frankly, these are related to the work. I'm trying to restructure the program for tomorrow because somebody's not coming, etc., and we're saying, no, they must come. I'm trying to sort out some things about a change in venue and so on. So it's all related to my work. I'm not SMSing my partner or my family. Now, I think I should tell you that. And let me tell you, if you've been here since 94 and you have listened to the likes of Derek Hanekom speak, droning on, you really learn to multitask. I'm quite capable of doing it, actually. In fact, you've got to challenge me. Say, Chairperson, what did I just say? 90% of the time, I'll repeat what you said. It's not a skill. It's just sheer boredom with being in Parliament, actually. You just acquire the skill. Can you carry on, please? Who is Now, I really know what you're saying. I mean, in other words, if I had my phone off and I was paying 100% attention to you, I still won't understand what some of the things you were saying. So it does, I don't understand everything. But to the extent you are comprehensible to somebody like me, for which I don't apologize for me, I don't have the tax degrees you have, I can tell you now that this thing doesn't interfere marginally only with my understanding or lack of understanding of what you say. Okay, over then to Groot Point. Famous Groot Point. Where are you? You're not here. Ah. Keith, I regret that we didn't give you half an hour at the beginning. All right. Normally they let the secretary know. Groot Point, yeah. Is this Groot Point? Oh, you are? Tax consulting essay. Oh, all right, okay. Thank you, Honourable Chair. My name is Jerry Goethe. I'm a tax practitioner. I'm represented by Keith, very much aligned to his thinking. I do apologise for treading over stuff that we've dealt with before, but this expat change is impacting a lot of South African lives now and into the future. So there's just some points I'd like to make, and I've changed my slides to not revisit stuff that we've dealt with before. The first principle is just this: if you're a non-resident for tax, South Africa doesn't tax you on your South African source income. So we don't worry about non-residents here. What we worry about is where a country retains residency for a very long time. And there are very, very few examples where countries keep residency as long as South Africa. And of course, a notable example, which is very sharp, to raise by one of the members of Parliament, is the US is another exception. So they say, if you're a US citizen or green card holder, we're going to keep you in our tax net forever. Keith, I think you might be subject to that. Yes. But what they've got is, they say, the first $102,100 that you earn a year as employment income is exempt. So don't be confused by the fact that they keep you in the tax net forever. They give you a massive exemption to not have to make you pay tax except if you enter a very high threshold. And there's good reason for this. This is tried and tested approach. I do think one should look at that. Just to make this very specific, who's going to get impacted by this? This will absolutely a student that want to go and work outside. I've got an example of that later for you. This will absolutely impact somebody that just qualified and want to go work outside to gain experience. And I implore you to please not run away from the real examples, because you're going to find students and newly qualified that want to gain that experience, but the only way they can gain that experience is either by not appearing, which is then they should go to jail, or by breaking ties with South Africa. And that we don't want, and I'll revisit that later.
It obviously deals with professionals throughout their career. We always, I guess, want them to have ties to South Africa. It deals with migrant workers. There's lots of them, South Africans working abroad. For whatever reason, they can't find work in South Africa in their profession, but they keep their families in South Africa, and they bring their money back, and they support families back in South Africa. Those are real examples. Of course, that's planning for retirement. And I must be very careful of coming up with odd examples, because I hate it when people bring up an example just to make a point. But I mean, we have to respect that other countries have got different tax regimes and different tax thresholds. So if you go and work in the UK, and in the UK you literally earn below the tax threshold in the UK as a student, you've got no tax to pay, because in their system there's no, you don't hit that threshold. In South Africa, if this rule comes through, you're going to have to pay 22,000 rand tax per year. And no student has got that money. And I know there's even people from SARS and National Treasury. I mean, I must be very blunt. I don't have that level of expertise, you know, to call out that section the way they do. But at the practical level, they gain those experience often by working internationally. And that is not a function of them being bad or evading tax. It's simply a function of, in the UK, the tax threshold is far, far higher than in South Africa. The current law change will impact that. Is it economic double taxation that we're talking about? Or is it economic double income taxation that we're talking about? What do you deal with if you deal with a country like the UAE? They've got very high taxes, but those are consumption-based taxes. And now we're hitting them with income tax. We're going to have to work our way through that. Then, of course, in South African law, and contrary to other examples, there is exemption for housing if you've got two houses in certain instances. But what if you're given security expenses in Africa? SARS are very clear and very correct. If you granted as an employee with a security detail and guards, etc., which is sometimes compulsory in locations where South Africans work, those things are fringe benefits. And, of course, very much to your point, Jim, person earlier, of confidentiality of taxpayers, SARS is bound to enforce that law. They're bound to tax that security expense. They can't say, oh, we would like to be nice and ignore that. They're going to have to work through that fringe benefit section piece by piece and tax security expenses and how they're going to get that reported. They can't look the other way. They're bound to enforce that. And of course, if you paid an allowance and you fly back to South Africa, you're going to have to get a tax deduction for that. And as an employee, it's impossible to get that tax deduction because of 23M. So I'm earning exactly the same as my South African counterpart, but I need to get home, and for that I get an allowance. I just would like a deduction for that. That's absolutely prohibited under South African law, section 23M. And these are massive changes that needs to be considered before we just wipe out little section 10102. So we really plead that this thing needs to be looked at properly. Otherwise, these are going to be the situations we find our residents in. In terms of double tax agreements, there's 73 DTAs. There's 193 countries. So there's a massive amount of countries that's not covered by DTAs. And please, for one second, I don't think it's easy to negotiate DTAs, and I would not want that task at all. I'm just pointing out that only in case of DTAs, if you've got that DTA exemption, where, by the way, if you've obviously been 10 years in the UK, you would claim a DTA exemption. But the problem with a DTA exemption is you have to claim it every single year in the tax return. Every single year you have to produce a tax residency certificate. In the UAE, every year you have to buy that certificate for 8,000 rand. And then you have to submit that to SARS. They have to adjudicate it. And then when you get into the tie bracket test and all the parameters of that, I assure you the banking law changes are easy peasy. Then we get into real complexities, enforcing that year after year. Obviously, if we're forcing guys into this where they're going to pay tax and they've got expenses which they can't deduct as employees, then we're forcing them to become all independent contractors, because independent contractors can deduct expense incurred in production of income. There's going to be huge effort around that. And of course, this is fertile grounds for tax schemes. Not South African hatched, overseas hatched. And I mean, I absolutely
despise those guys coming up with schemes that don't work. I wish there's a way we can take them down, but unfortunately they remain reality. You know, I'm completely incapable of advising SARS or National Treasury how to stop share scheme leakage, but for the past 10 years we've had to change law to try and catch that. It just keeps on a moving target, and there's operators out there that consistently scheme like that in South Africa, just wait for the international market to start targeting South Africans to avoid tax. Then just in terms of tax evasions, I love the term mischief rule by some of my learned fellow presenters. There must be a very good reason why SARS is targeting this. I'm fully aware they must have excellent examples of guys that's done the wrong stuff. Please, non-compliance does not get corrected with the unjust rule, of which there's no equivalent in the rule, or in law, or anywhere in the world. It gets corrected by world-class revenue authority that hold those non-compliance guys accountable, and that hold them account for the benefit of all South Africans. So please target the non-compliance ones, but do not make the good guys fall because of this law change. Two wrongs do not make a right. And as far as other government officials are concerned, I think there was talk about, yes, but government officials are taxed. That's globally the same. If you're a government official, you go work in another country, you pay tax per that rule, and that's an easy fix in terms of rule to do that. The last point, July 2017, there was an excellent white paper introduced on international migration by the Department of Home Affairs. It is really a good document. That's what policy is about. And you'll see those policy objectives on management of ties with South African expats. And that policy says their objectives on its noteworthy interventions to enable development purposes, study, work and business abroad, inward investment, skills and capital, and those wishing to return to South Africa. We ask, we plead for tax policy that align to those objectives. We do, please ask, don't force us through now, quickly through law, because every day we get contacted by guys that want to take international assignments up, but they're worried that they're going to pay tax on international income. If it's at all possible, follow the cue of the Department of Home Affairs. Let's get a white paper out. Let's ventilate this. Let's understand where you're coming from. Let's get good comparable examples with BRICS countries, not just DOT country. And let's please just make an informed decision on that. Thank you.
Right. Next, just to alert Growthpoint, you've come now. Your colleagues are so intimidated by the portfolio committee that they didn't use their full time. So we couldn't break and, you know, wait. We obviously allowed now will you go for your, you've got 10 minutes, late, most 12 minutes, thank you. Thank you very much, expatriate petition.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bram Horsens. I'm representing Growthpoint and the wider South African REIT Association. I mean, just maybe as a very quick background, the Real Estate Investment Trust legislation, specifically Section 25BB of the Income Tax Act and various other amendments to the Income Tax Act at the time, was only introduced in April 2013. And I think that's very important that any new legislation that's radical of that nature will require multiple follow-on amendments to make sure that there's no unintended consequences and that there's, that in practice, the practical implementation follows the original intention of that legislation. Now, as the SA REIT Association, we've made a number of submissions over the years as some of these unintended consequences. And I've chosen this slot just to highlight a few of those that I think are probably low-hanging fruit and fairly easy to address. And we've just, apologies, we don't have it up on the screen, but we've just handed out a brief presentation that just picks up on a few of these points. And then at the end, I'll highlight some of the other ongoing points that we've made submissions on that we believe probably fairly easy to fix. So I think the SA REIT legislation has had a fantastic impact on the South African economy. It's created a sector that's drawn a lot of capital into it. Counters like Growthpoint and Redefine are on global indexes, so that results in foreign capital inflows into the country, and it's to the benefit of the country that legislation is cleaned up a little bit. So the first point I want to touch on is the definition of rental income in Section 25 CB. And the background to that is that 75% of a REIT's income needs to be rental income in order for it to qualify for the specific tax dispensation. Given the international expansion of a lot of the South African counters, we've seen an increased use of derivative instruments, specifically an instrument which is rather complicated to explain, but it's known as a cross-currency swap, and that results in an interest income leg on the income statement, which technically in terms of the way the legislation is written at the moment, or Section 25 PB is written at the moment, probably be interpreted to fall outside of the rental income definition. And it's important that those flows are of an ordinary course of, or is in the ordinary course of business, and we feel that Section 25 PB should be amended to specifically include derivative flows inside the definition of rental income to avoid that unintended consequence that a big counter might be, let's call it, de-reated for the lack of a better word. So the second point, and we believe this is quite a low-hanging fruit and should be quite easy to address, is that Section 46 and 47 of the Income Tax Act have never been amended to allow for reorganizations in a REIT context. And without going into too much detail, but we're saying that, for example, if you unbundle or you have a liquidation distribution, it will result in an unintended consequence because you have a dividend in the holding company that's taxable, which you won't be declaring to your shareholder. I mean, the idea of a REIT is that it's tax neutral, that the tax is passed on to its shareholders. This, if you did actually unbundle a group structure, you'd have tax leakage in the holding company. So, and we believe this is a fairly easy amendment to make, and we've made submissions on this in the past. The next one is of interest to the historians that remember the property loan stocks. And if you think back, the attraction of a property loan stock is that it was quite a high interest-bearing instrument. Same thing with the REIT. We pay 100% 100% of the dividends out to our shareholders. So it attracts a number of smaller retired people that invest small sums of money that live off of the income. And from changing from a property loan stock to a REIT, most of those investors lost their initial interest exemption. And we believe that actually just makes sense, that there's an old granny in Uppington, she's making 50,000 Rand of REIT dividends a year, that she should also be allowed to get an interest deduction in line as she would have gotten in the past on a property loan stock, or if she put an investment or a retirement savings in any other fixed income venture. And again, I believe a minor amendment to Section 10(1)(i) in this case would fix this very easily. The next item is slightly more complicated. I mean, Section 24i, the way it's drafted currently, brings most foreign exchange gains or unrealized foreign exchange gains on derivative instruments into the income tax. Given that those are not cash items, they will not typically be distributed to a REIT's shareholders. And further, a REIT can't create an assessed loss with its qualifying distribution, which means that there's an unintended consequence that a REIT is actually specifically disadvantaged where they use foreign exchange derivative instruments. So we believe that specifically to REITs, or in terms of Section 25 PB, exchange gains on unrealized derivative instruments shouldn't be included in the income tax or in the gross income of a REIT. And the final point I just want to highlight is that, and this is maybe a divergence between the intention and policy, we've found that a number of, and it follows SARS's guidelines, a number of SARS officers are interpreting that the REIT dividend that's received in a group environment, they're applying that for a general apportionment for VAT purposes, which means, and in the way of, just to step back, a REIT is often structured in a way that there's a number of propcos underlying the holding company. I mean, typically you'd have a holding company that's listed, you have a number of subsidiaries beneath that. Those dividends have to flow up in order for each of those subsidiaries to pay a qualifying distribution. SARS is then looking at the top company in the pyramid and saying you're receiving largely dividend income and therefore you can't claim your input VAT or you need to apportion. And that, in our mind, is clearly an unintended consequence of the REIT legislation. So our suggestion is that a qualifying distribution from a subsidiary company should be excluded from the computation of apportionment for VAT purposes. So those were the more low hanging fruit that we believe just makes sense and would fall within the original intention of the legislation. There's a few others that are slightly more specific that I've just listed on the last page, which I don't want to go into detail now. It's just where a REIT holds a trust, or where pension funds like the PSC hold big stakes in JV with a REIT, and you've got interest limitations under Section 23M. We also see a lot of double taxation of our members where they have foreign holdings. So you've got withholding tax on the foreign in the foreign country, and you've got tax on your shareholding in South Africa. There's some problems with intercompany disposals, and we make a capital gain, which then unintendedly becomes taxable. And we see a number of problems in the CFC area. But I don't want to go into all of that, taking cognizance of the limited time, but we have made full submissions on this. So that's all from our side, yeah.
Okay. What happened to tax consulting, SN? And then, but who's expatriate petition group? So you're the last. Fine, go ahead. The slide you had, which confused me, tax consulting, you had about expatriate petition and so on. Are you working together?
Yes, Chair. I deal with the technical stuff a bit, and Barry deals more to just explain, you know, the practicalities of
okay.
many expats are under.
All right, fine.
Honourable members of Parliament, members of the tax and financial professions, and my fellow South Africans, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you today on behalf of the South Africans residing and working abroad and their families, those whose families are still based in South Africa, as well as the many South Africans wanting to venture abroad to work. I'm here today all the way from the United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, where I've been working and residing since 2013. I'm an engineer by occupation. I started working at Firestone in Port Elizabeth in 1978. I have always enjoyed taking part in good causes such as mentoring of young engineers from diverse backgrounds. My current work function includes programming and commissioning of complex automation systems and industrial databases for a company called Alhassan Gas, a 125 million rand venture started up in 2014, a leader in sour gas development fields. I also contribute largely to the world-class youth development programs. Working for the United Arab Emirates ADNOC government-based group, my work is obviously governed by high security and confidentiality provisions. My wish as a South African is to eventually return to my country of birth and to share my skills and expertise with the next generation. When this law change was announced, we expats abroad thought it was fake news. We actually shouted at the gentlemen sitting around me in reply to them. We could not believe that a law so unjust would be proposed. It was astounding to us. India considered a similar proposal in 2014, a short while back. Their president, Narendra Modi, based on inputs from the Indian expats and the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates, realized a mistake was being made and they actually corrected their path. I formed a Facebook group. Currently, 14,000 plus members, and a petition signed by more than 12,000 members, whom has done, by the way, 1,384 official submissions to the Treasury and the Receiver by the closing date of the 18th of August. 1,384. So we are participating. News in the media informed us that both the Treasury and SARS made reference to us in Parliament, referred to us. We acknowledge with appreciation that they recognize us. However, we must humbly point out that both their numbers and assumptions noted was incorrect. The draft bill of repeal of Article 10 has resulted in confusion and stress abroad, which is unprecedented. It has led to a groundswell of voices that we humbly ask you, honourable members, to pay attention to and to consider. These are the average working class citizens that represent the true multicolours of our rainbow nation, busy earning an honest wage, facing the additional challenges of living in foreign countries. Surviving in these places, as specifically the low tax regions, which works on consumption-based taxes. There is not no taxes. That is a fallacy. It's a challenge in itself. All foreign nationals, including South Africans, by the structures and measures they have in place, inject 70% of our income back into that local economy. This, with the result that we may end up as tax agents, has caused unprecedented levels of stress. Young South Africans have joined our group in numbers, now questioning their ability. Should I take a job or shouldn't I? Should I come abroad? Will I be able to live and pay these taxes? At 3:30 this morning, I was messaging with a single mother in Dubai. She has an autistic child. Her stress was through the roof early this morning. Yet she still supports her mother and father back here, living in our country. These people must be heard. They must be taken to heart and mind when considering this repeal. The confusion and stress is also caused by a lack of clarity of the myriad tax laws governing and defining tax residency, which may be an unintended consequence of repealing this tax article. It is resulting in decisions being made right now, which is bad for South Africans and the economy of our country, not in 2 years' time. Those living abroad are obligated to meet the structures and the laws of the country they reside in. We South Africans are known for our ability to think outside the box. We have a tenacity in delivering world-class services, enabling us to be competitive in this global marketplace. Repeal of Article 10 will seriously reduce our ability to deliver. The high cost of private schooling, take note, we may not use state-funded schools. We pay for private schools. A six-year-old child, basic, starts at 200,000 rand per annum. These are facts, ladies and gentlemen. I live there. Housing, a single-bedroom apartment that you would live comfortably in here in SA for 6,500 rand per month, starts and runs at 60 to 70,000 rand per month with little options available. These factors are built into our packages with no options to downscale, to change our lifestyle, and no recourse to claim deductions. None exists in the current tax system. This places us into the higher South African tax brackets, where in reality where we live, many of us, most of us, in the low and middle class income groups, relative to where we live. After meeting all these obligations, living their day to day, what little capital we have left, we inject back home, back into the economy. This group, whom the members of the National Treasury and the media has referred to, as well as the petition we submitted officially, is not the misconception of the salary earners abroad. It is a large support base of supporters from foreign nationals and South Africans who are not necessarily part of those obligated to do tax returns. So do not see that 14,000 as potential taxpayers. Many South Africans abroad, some left here as students, very much ignorant of tax laws, have been advised by tax consultants to either submit zero value tax returns, no tax returns, and for those who have been abroad based for many years, don't bother to do a tax return. Some of SARS call center employees, upon these expats calling, have given the same advice. There does seem to be within these professions some history of confusion, which creates more confusion to the workers abroad. I understand SARS must collect taxes fairly. However, I pose this. If they quote our humble Facebook group as an authority, I as an engineer who has worked my whole life with numbers and used databases, I am telling you the research has not been done. I would like to see that research if it does exist. And if so, they should have quoted those values and statistics, not use a Facebook group as a reference. South Africans abroad are a valuable export of this country.
You're at 10 minutes, but we're lost in
altitude. Many of us would want to one day return to South Africa. However, we are now left with two options. Either cut financial ties, abandon our country and its economy, or, because we cannot pay these taxes, return to South Africa, a job market under stress, more than 27% currently unemployment. Where are we going? Both these choices are bad for South Africa. Large numbers have already, within this confusion, started emigrating, many unnecessarily. We urgently need to stop this outflow of both human and fiscal resources from our country. In line with the government's intent to actually have South Africans return, this should be done not by means of punitive tax measures, but by encouraging and schemes to bring us back. South Africans are now considering retiring, middle-aged gentlemen like myself, to countries offering very attractive golden parachute passports and citizenship. In addition, many of the permanent resident based citizen resident group in the UAE, the no low tax countries, have started obtaining tax domicile certificates at 8,750 odd rand per annum, which they, in line with international treaties, are contesting that they are not ordinary tax residents of South Africa. Before the repeal of Article 10 is even considered, the full scope, extent and viability thereof should be taken into account, measured in terms of financial and human factors mentioned today. 194 of 196 countries do not tax their expats. 194 out of 196. The company I work at has 23 nationalities working there. I've spoken to them one by one. Not one of them pays taxes back to their country of origin. I ask you to consider these factors today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Right, over to members. Alf.
Good
be multi-partyist.
We see the mics more. Only on tax issues. Yes, I've noticed that, Mr. Chairman. A Facebook page, of course, is not an empirical evidence, but it does give an indication of the extent of concern out there. And of course, it shouldn't be used. I personally receive emails probably from the same members of your Facebook on a daily basis. And so there's definitely concern out there. There's no question about that. And so what we said earlier in our discussion is important in that we all accept that double non-taxation seems to be the mischief, but the way we deal with it seems to some extent to have not been fully considered what all the consequences would be. And I think that National Treasury have been listening, and despite France's reference to the Facebook page at our last meeting, which is being referred to this morning, National Treasury are logical, sensible people, and won't, I'm sure, refuse to consider the very real issues that are involved here. So, Mr. Chairman, I really don't have anything more to add than that. South African expats are usually highly skilled people, whether they're highly skilled nurses and so on. We want them back. We want our economy to grow. We certainly don't want at any stage to encourage them to give up their, or somehow find a way of giving rid of their South African tax residency as opposed to passports and citizenships, which Chris has pointed out so clearly to us. So all I would say to your colleagues abroad, sir, is that please ask them to be patient. I'm sure between National Treasury and us here and professionals sitting across from me, we'll find a solution to this. People should not rush into anything, but quite clearly I can't make promises. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I noticed that nobody emails me or SMSs me. Who do they think is running the country here? So it's fine. In a democracy, whether you like it or not, whether you like the majority party or not, it is the primary determinant, having listened to everybody, of policies. That's what democracy is about. But absolutely nobody's petitioned me, which makes me deeply suspicious. Yeah, no, I'm being facetious, but how serious. Secondly, Gloria wants to speak.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think National Treasury probably better to ask to answer the question I'm about to ask. I just want to, I'm curious, given the pushback to the repeal of 1010 exemption, we know that government employees were not part of this exemption, particularly with the SOE employees. I'm just curious, how vocal have they been in the past to be included in the exemption, and why have we not seen recommendations to include them in the exemption? And then to the petition group, I'm just curious, with the people taking part in this Facebook group, are all these people South Africans working abroad, or is it just people in solidarity of the group? Thanks.
Anybody else? Dimasani?
Chair, mine is just really a recommendation, really, because clearly the foreign income exemption, there's a lot of things that are composed together as one thing. I think there's a quite good temptation to actually break it down and deal with it like that, as opposed to dealing with it quite comprised. Because I think, as a tax knowledgeable person myself, I'm sympathetic to some of the issues are raised, but at the same time, some of the things I'm not agreeing with them. So probably the challenge is to put everything together. Maybe you need to break them down. But I think one of the questions which I think PwC asked, which is quite tried to answer, which is quite nicely, the issue of the numbers around this whole thing. What are the numbers? Because I mean, one of the bigger problem that as tax payers we have a problem with is a lot of compliance issues that, you know, take too much of our time. I can imagine as an expatriate sitting there having to comply with a lot of paperwork and all of that, versus being the benefits of it as well. I mean, is Treasury expecting some, I mean, I understand there are moral issues, compliance issues, economic skills, there's a lot of issues out there. But I'm saying, are the costs versus the benefits analysis been done in this chair? Thanks.
Yeah, Alf.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to add that there has been a kind of suggestion, perhaps not in this room today, but that people, let me step back and point. When people make a decision which is quite a major consequence in their lives, they take into account laws that pertain at that particular time. And so people who've gone abroad have done so having done their calculations and in terms of existing law. And so it's not really fair for us to change that midstream. Perhaps they've got a 5-year contract or whatever. So that aspect, I'm sure, has to be taken into account. And it's all very well to say that foreign employers will probably pick up, I think Chris, you said this last time, will pick up the additional tax. It might not be the case. I'm sorry, Chris, you didn't actually say that would be the case, but there was a suggestion somewhere that might, I don't want to put words in your mouth, forgive me, let me withdraw that. And so it's really, one's got to perhaps look at this not just in a 2-year, I think, position that Nyanga is talking about, but in terms of where people are in their careers abroad. There are others who are there on a permanent basis. Now, you know, what does one do with those? So it's complicated, Mr. Chairman.
Firstly, can Treasury respond to the view that you did very little or inadequate research? What has been your research? Is it strictly that you looked at the Facebook or find a thought to believe that make you insight, as Al says? Secondly, but it's not really the basis on which you can make decisions about this, and I don't think you did it like that. Secondly, just to assure, as Al has already done, that up till now we found Treasury and SARS quite reasonable. I know you may not agree, but from the point of view of MPs, and they do reasonably good. After all, notwithstanding the current crisis, world crisis, challenges SARS experiences, overall it's still globally highly regarded, and it remains resilient for now. And, you know, that's one measure at least that an average MP would use to judge some of its proposals. Thirdly, the gentleman who came from the expatriate petition group, I would hope you didn't come here solely for this purpose, but you came to do other work. But if you have, then it implies that you are, as a group, very highly stressed and you speak for this group. But there are other ways of communicating to us, which is we read your text and so on, and presumably you can arrange for somebody else to speak on your behalf here. So when you have these workshops, it's your call. This is your parliament too. Never mind that you, wherever you are, this is your parliament. You have the right to vote, though you're based elsewhere. So, you know, it's fine for you to come. But I'm just saying that you would have decided a cost-benefit thing. Maybe you sent a representative within South Africa's resident here to speak on your behalf at the workshops, but it's your call. I do want to ask, you say that you've
strange, we received 1,384 submissions. Are they specifically different submissions, or it's a petition? You know, sometimes it's a standard thing, and then they attach 1,384. If you have 1,384 distinct and separate petitions, submissions, wow, that's all I can say, wow, then you're not ready to come on the 12th. Because you do a million other things, so maybe that's another thing you should do, because you have to look at all of them. but I presume even one person, I'm not saying it happened, we're in parliament now, and something wrong with that. In politics, I would do the same if I was in civil society. I can mobilize my entire clan in Pietermaritzburg, all my school friends, and I can write it out for them, and they can just sign without even reading it. What's wrong with that? I don't have a problem with that. That's politics, right? So I hope it's a petition, but I'd like to know how far you've gone in reading this 1,384 submissions. Then in the expatriate petition group, who are you exactly? Do you represent only the residents from UAE, or you're a global? And if so, how many members have you got? Or if it's an ad hoc structure, how many people do you speak for? What percentage of the expatriates this is? I hear what Elf says. It hadn't struck me before, Elf, that you plan to do something. And then you suddenly get imposed with taxes and all those things. But those things are also things that can be addressed in some way. So, the other thing that occurs to me, and remember, I'm still finding my way. I'll be more comfortable 2 weeks from now. And I regret that I could not attend the last meeting because I had to go to a funeral. And Derek, of course, has got a much firmer grasp on these issues because he was chairing. When you chair, he knows you've got to be more alert on reflection. Maybe he should have chaired this meeting, frankly. Also, because he's an emerging tax expert, as we've been trying to negotiate with him. But we need somebody, it's an in-house matter on the ANC side beside Tandi, to be more serious. And we're hoping that he might play some role, but we'll negotiate that. So what I'm saying is that, look, I won't blabber on. I'll organize my thoughts over the next 2 weeks. then the on growth point, on the, okay, I'll drop this one, and I want to actually understand what you're saying better before I say much more. Okay, does anybody else would say anything before we hand over to Treasury and then the other participants? Right, Treasury, please.
Thank you, Chair. Chris is going to respond on the empirical evidence and the research on Section 10.1.0. But on the other issue of growth point, we wish to put on record that the submission by growth point is not on the 2017 draft TLEP. The issues that they are raising, they are not in the draft bill that is in front of Parliament today. Thank you.
But on the issue of research and all, somebody's going to deal with that, right? Can I also ask another question, right? It's a mechanical formulation. There's something there in the HPL that I'm also pushing for in 2 weeks' time. You see, rather than dropping it all together, because you must, and I'm going to look carefully, have at some basis at least to want to do this, right, 10.1.0, and sort of just having it as it is there no phased, incremental, in-between answer? You know, that opens the door, but takes into account of the things Alf has said. I'm not compelled, by the way, it's a passionate input, but to be fair, I mean, ultimately, we have to judge things, there's no want of a better word, rationally. I'm not entirely compelled by the tax consulting essay or the expatriate. And I understand where they're going, but I don't think that precludes Treasury doing something. But can't you strike a deal? Like one option, maybe defer it for a year, give more time so people understand you. Where's the research? Right? Did you do research? What was the extent of the research? That's a fair thing to ask. And can you edge towards, I'm saying come back in 2 weeks, but we're also priming you to find some sort of resolution. Ideally, colleagues, what we should be doing here, it's something we've raised over the last 2.5 years, but we never summoned the
capacity to do it, you know, off the cuff, so to speak. What we should be doing is setting a framework as MPs for striking deals between both sides or several sides, between Treasury, South, and the civil society stroke professional strata that are here. And we should be sending a multi-party team to your workshops. Because the bill is, okay, it's not formally tabled, right, Yanga? But it's, if we have hearings, it's semi-formally here. So we should be there, right? But now, with a million things to do, how does the chair get there? So it's something we need to apply our mind to, which is, in future, there should be a subcommittee comprising somebody other than the chairperson chairing it, and the one representative may be from each of the other parties that wants to go. And while you handle the workshop for a day, day and a half, ultimately at the end of it, the MP say, right, this half a day, we take over. So we don't sit here in Parliament, you know, consuming so much of time. This is something we need to apply our minds to. We'll have to discuss it with Treasury. We will have to think about it. And then we send our researchers, Zakela et al. And PBO. Although PBO, if you ask them for advice, they'll say, no, it's not our job. So frankly, I don't even care where the PBO goes. No, we forget PBO. They just come here and they say, no, we are independent, and so on. Well, this is not Europe. This is not Switzerland, where, you know, the MPs there come from the industry, right? But that's PBO for you. So really, I don't care much about PBO going, because there won't be any mediating role. They'll be using up taxpayers' money. They'll be, what? It'll be for your personal edification. No, we're not using tax money for that. We want mediation. We want compromises. So if you prepare to play some role in that regard, yes, but otherwise we'd PBO out. Zakele must go, you know, and assist the MPs, hopefully Derek Hanekom and his team next year. never mind what you're thinking about Derek. I'm quite confident. Right, let's go on.
Thanks, Chair. So there are quite a few questions. I'll try and go through them as robustly or as comprehensively as I can. National Treasury did make a presentation to the committee a week or two ago on a lot of these issues. I hope to show that there was considered thought behind this proposal. We didn't just make this up and put it in. I would strongly contest against the claims that this is not done elsewhere. The research that we have done and has been said before by participants earlier today was that this is not an abnormal provision that we are putting in. If you look at Australia, it's exactly the same as Australia. If you look at New Zealand, it's exactly the same as New Zealand. If you look at Canada, it's exactly the same as Canada. And a lot of those ordinary resident tests are also very similar. If you still have a car registered in your name in Canada, you're still seen as a tax resident in that country, regardless of where you and your family are living. So this is not completely out of line with everything that's gone on in the rest of the world. We have been out of line with the rest of the world. For example, there are some other cases where there are specific exemptions. So yes, we are similar to Australia, New Zealand, Canada, but there are other countries which have particular exemptions to try and lessen the burden. For example, in the UK, if you're out of the country, I think it's for more than 339 days, then it's exempt. So in effect, at the moment, we have a 183-day test. The UK, for example, I think it's a 349, it's 300, it's around by day test, and if you're out for longer than that, you're out. Spain has an exemption where if you the first X amount that you earn, regardless of how long you're out of the country, is exempt. The US has that exemption, but it's completely different to us, and that's, I think, where a lot of people get very concerned and very upset about citizenship. And there was one very strong article which actually completely misinterpreted the proposal about citizenship, because it's not based on citizenship. In the US, it is based on citizenship. And yes, you have a 100,000 exemption, but that's only if you are outside of the U.S. for more than 330 days. So in effect, it's a 330-day test, not a 183-day test. And you can live in the other country for 20, 30 years, as long as you're still a U.S. citizen, you are still paying above that exemption. So it's a lot stricter than ours. So This is just trying to show that we have gone through these studies. We didn't just do this without looking at any other countries. You know, in terms of the numbers, what are the numbers? We can look at OECD net migration statistics. It gives us some idea, you know, tens of thousands in different countries. We can look at Stats SA, household surveys, shows how many people have left. Again, can give us some idea. The big problem with those statistics is it doesn't talk about tax residency. It just talks about people who've left. For the person who up and goes to the country and they take their whole family and they sell their car, they do everything, they're gone, they're no longer tax resident. But which doesn't help us in this context because it's about tax residency, it's not about just where you are. So it's difficult to look at that. We've looked at the assessment data that SARS have provided to Treasury on an anonymized basis in terms of who should be, how many people this has impacted. Now when we look at that, you can claim an you can claim the actual exemption, the Section 10102 exemption. There's a source code you put in your assessment and you actually claim it. And if you are a tax resident and you're overseas and you're earning income, you should be declaring that income and then claiming the exemption. But from our statistics, there were 5,109 people who claimed that exemption in 2014-15. And that was where the discussion on the Facebook group came from, because I said that that seems to be too low. And I think given the response from this proposal, that certainly is too low. Now, I'm not saying that it was, I don't know, I can't say about wrong or not, but a lot of people probably thought they didn't need to declare that income because it's got no taxable impact. Okay, and maybe we haven't been enforcing it as strongly or forcing them to actually declare that income. I'm just trying to tell you the numbers that we've had. So in our view, if those were the full numbers, this would have a very small impact on 5,109 people. But obviously it's a lot more than that. I mean, in terms of the rationale for the principle, we're talking a lot about it's for people with double non-taxation and they should pay their fair share. But it's also, it is about the underlying rationale behind a residency-based system. If you're a tax resident, which a lot of these other countries have definitions for tax resident, you should be paying your fair share. And at the moment, and it's difficult, we sort of opened this debate, but a lot of affairs haven't been formalized for people who've left. So they might have left ages ago, and they're still seen as tax resident, but actually they're not tax resident. But now this proposal is putting them in a difficult position, because what do you do? Because if you now say, well, actually I don't want to be tax resident anymore, and you go tell SARS, SARS will say, okay, but for you to be a non-tax resident, we will charge capital gains tax on your worldwide assets. Okay. So now it is putting people in a difficult position. We're listening to this. It's very difficult for us to make these decisions and come to this information before we do the proposal, because nobody will come forward. So we have to do the proposal and then we see the circumstances. We've got those 1,300 and a little bit more responses that we've got. I mean, just to tell the share, you did ask about that. So we've got, our team is going through all those responses. So every response will be read and will be considered. A lot of them follow the same format, but actually a lot of them are people who have put in effort to write about their particular circumstances. And we are going through those and we are trying to consider them. For example, the phasing in, all those other things will be really considered. We're not going to try and be draconian on this rule. I think another implication that we did mention in the last meeting was that we've shown that the implications of this are severe. If you're in a no-tax country and it goes through as is, I think it was if you're earning R1 million in the UAE, R1 million in rand terms, then it's an additional R315,000 in tax that you need to pay. So we are fully cognizant of the potential implications here. But does that mean you should then become non-tax resident so you don't have to pay that tax? But then you must formalize your affairs with SARS. And those are the things that we're trying to consider. So there was another point on the net contracts. I did say that, you know, I personally know of some people, and we have spoken to some companies who do it, that they do it, they do their contracts on net contracts. So that means your take-home pay is the same regardless of where you're from. So if you're a company operating in another jurisdiction and you employ a lot of expats, those expats, if they are British expats, Australian expats, US expats, whoever, they will be paying tax back to their home country. but they will be on net contracts so that the net take-home pay is exactly the same regardless of the different tax treatments in the different countries. And then if you're a South African, you're also on a net contract. So if tax is not applied depending on your contract, the firm might then be required to pay more in tax. But what will it mean? It certainly would mean that if you're not on net contract, you get a big hit in pay, and it certainly will lower the competitiveness of those South African employees offshore. They'll then be seen on the same level as the others, which will, in effect, be detrimental to their competitiveness. But that's another interesting question. I'm just going to leave it open. It might be a bit contentious. But, you know, if they should be paying tax, but now they're not paying tax, so that they are more competitive offshore, you know, is it almost an incentive for skilled people? You know, are we creating an incentive for them to get these jobs? And we are very concerned about keeping people here, keeping the skills here, and we want them to come back. We certainly don't want to scare people off into giving up their passports. Don't do that. You know, and people mustn't. And I know of people who've been given advice that they should give up their passports. And this is still a draft. We're still discussing, and they mustn't. And we do want them to come back. But we do also need to formalize this. And it seems as if we have been too generous in the past. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but we're willing to consult and we're willing to make amendments if we need to. And I think I've covered everything. But when we come back in our responses, we'll lay this all out and try and give more information if we need to. Thanks, Chair.
All right. Over then to who spoke first. It was tax consulting. Growth point. Well, it doesn't matter. But tax consulting.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, National Treasury, Chris. We've been heard, and we would very much like to give input. And I know you've been an expat yourself, so you get us. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Mrs. Chair. I mean, there wasn't much discussion about our comments, so it's not too much for me to add, but we take note of Treasury's comments of placing that our submission wasn't formally part of this T-Lab round, but we would like to encourage ongoing engagement with our body, and we'd like to open that up. I mean, I think we can only benefit from that, and echoing your sentiments from earlier that we can resolve this issue before they come here. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then finally, the gentleman from Expatriate Petition Group, EPG, I'll call you for now.
Thank you. Just to enlighten or give some answers to some of the honourable members' comments or actual questions made. Firstly, regarding the demography, the group, who are they? Yes, they are not just actual South Africans working abroad. They are from, and this has been formally submitted, I actually gave the information of all the countries. It is vast. Vietnam, South Korea, Bermuda, Isle of Man, Taiwan, Hong Kong, USA, UK. I could sit here and name you 40 countries I have members from. Many, many young professional engineers from South Africa. Mahoba Nia, a light I mentored, contacted me 2 days ago saying, Barry, I'm looking at a job coming out, but I'm not sure whether I should take it. So it is literally in the past 6 months, I have been speaking with people from all corners of the world, and the mothers, the grandfathers, yeah, who are getting money from them to survive or to do whatever they do. So that 14,000 is not SARS tax number people. It's a widespread, and it's from literally all over the world that have joined the group. The other point I would like to touch on, which this honourable gentleman mentioned, is the financial commitment of the various, the 20-something, the 30-something, the midlifers like me. Take into consideration, based upon this package, which I took a contract independently with a foreign company, I don't have a South African base. There's no tax equalization. I'm on my own, and a huge amount of the support base is that group. Okay, so there's no somebody's going to pay us net, or I'm a layman like you, so I don't know all these fancy words. But the net result is we basically on our own. Based on that, I am doing retirement funding out of pocket. I have committed to a 10, 15 year plan, and the younger they are, the longer the terms they've committed to. On these packages in lieu of what we have, because we have to grow our own pension funds. Keep in mind these companies, it's not like in South Africa where the employers here contribute to a pension fund for you. You're on your own. You have to set up them when you hit 63. You're not going to come back here and I'm going to walk into Parliament and say, okay, please give me a monthly pension now, which I've not contributed to. I have to carry that burden. So we are locked into much longer than 1 year and 7 months before 1 March 2019. So you leave us with the option of, okay, I stop this investment and take, depending how long I've been into it, I take a massive hit and loss because I can no longer pay it, afford it, because I must now pay my taxes. That's the position you are placing in. These are not tax avoiders. These are not tax evaders. These are people that are scared, gentlemen, I am telling you. And they are confused. The cart has been put in front of the horses. What do you expect when you say, we're appealing this law? And then no clear clarity. It's a massive confusion out there that I've been living with day and night for the last 6 months. These are not giants, these are not corporations. The Middle Eastern countries, the oil and gas industry is under huge stress. It's a dwindling resource. Renewable green sources are coming up. Even what's in the United Arab Emirates has 70 years of resources left at current extraction. And because they're going faster and faster, they're draining it faster. Why? Because with solar and this, there's a break-even point where even if they still have some left, they won't be able to sell it. In the last 2 years, just to put it, and I'll throw the figures out to you. In the last 2 years, my salary has been reduced by 28,000 rand per month. No negotiation, that's it. Cut away. My holiday has been cut away. That of 5% is coming to the UAE. When I talk about consumption-based taxes, you have to understand, these countries do not use those words. They use the words of levies and building it into food and so on. So it does exist. It's just not called tax. I think those were the main questions that were asked. Thank you for your time and attention.
Welcome, Joan. This is Joan Fox, Chair of the Trade and Industry. This is the Finance Committee meeting. Yeah, okay. Erica?
Thank you, Chair. I would be appreciative if I can just spend 1 or 2 minutes on the topic of tax administration at a very high level, please. On tax administration, we just wanted to mention that there really is a need for justice for taxpayers and balance in terms of administrative process. And the taxpayers are really feeling that the rules are one-sided and they violate their basic rights. And why I think it's so important to raise this in Parliament is that we always get the opportunity in NHSC to make proposals for the budget. And our NHSC proposals then get discussed at the workshops with Treasury every year. But in this past year, we made tax administrative proposals, and there was no workshop held on them. So we didn't have any opportunity to discuss our proposals or to get any feedback. And to this day, we haven't had any feedback formally on those proposals that we made. So we do think that that process is not nearly as consultative as it should be. And we also question whether there's a sufficient separation of powers between the lawmakers in Treasury and in SARS in that regard. There are very few positive amendments in the Tax Admin Act this year of any substance. And there are a lot of things that haven't been done, which, you know, we obviously listed in our NHSC submissions. And just maybe one example is the suspension of payment matter, where if you get assessed for tax, you have to pay now and argue later. And there are certain limited circumstances where you can then apply for a suspension of payment. And these suspension requests then sometimes get disallowed, either for the reason that you haven't complied with all the strict requirements, or because you maybe can't provide enough security that you'll actually have the tax to pay it, even if that tax debt is very big and not necessarily a legitimate debt. And you can, if this request for suspension is denied, you have no remedy but to go to the High Court then to get that to basically challenge that denial. So you can't go through normal remedies, tax board, etc. It's an expensive High Court application, and you have to get an interdict in the meantime to stop SARS from forcing you to pay. And in doing this, a small business can quite easily be bankrupt. So that's just one example, and we had many, and they are also included in our longer submissions. And we haven't even had a response to that. So we're trying to engage constructively, and we're just asking for more of a consultative process.
On your point that there's a confusion of roles, or there isn't a separation of powers, if that's what you said, between the spheres in this regard.
We, with the other laws, other tax laws, in other words, the substantive tax laws, other than the Tax Admin Act, Treasury drives the process. And they would schedule these workshops that we're going to have next week, etc. Okay? So there's a lot of interaction and consultation, and we get an opportunity to comment. Now, normally each year in this process, there would also be a workshop on the tax administration bill, but that would be largely driven by SARS. So we're basically saying SARS are policing themselves. They drive the legislative changes to the Tax Administration Act, which governs the way they then, you know, interact with the taxpayer.
Right. So, Younger, do you want to respond in your team to what Eric has said, and specifically respond to this confusion of roles that SARS has? Or, you know, irreconcilable roles.
Thank you, Chair. This has been a long-standing issue. The Tax Administration Act came in 2011, and it governs how SARS work. And there's been a long-standing issue that SARS drives the Tax Administration Act. We've had discussions. I think we're
going to
resolve that.
Any other issue that Eric has said, does any one of your team want to respond? No. So in that case, is there anybody else who wants to say anything before we draw to a close? No. All right. Well, we finished earlier, astonishingly, than we planned to, 45 minutes earlier. And I was hoping that the MPs at least would applaud me, but they don't seem to care. We say 45 minutes. Normally they accuse me of blabbering too much. Where's Derek, by the way? Okay, now let's say that we made our points. We're not going to cover them. It's not the end of the world. 10-1-0, you can strike some deals, right? And you, at this stage, will come back on the 12th. You will look up the website and see when, in fact, if it's a few days before, just check if it's on the 12th or later. Then I've got nothing more to say. Except that tomorrow we're looking at illicit financial flows with the Trade and Industry, Police, Minerals Committees. And Alan is on leave, so Tebogo will take responsibility. We'll meet now to ensure that everything works out tomorrow. Also to say that because of this International Women's Conference, and there was no accommodation for the committee's meeting today, I'll gather from Tebogo that there are confusions. I'm not responsible for this. Let me switch this off.
I'm not responsible.